Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Joseph Daly for the plaintiff appellant. I'm going to try to reserve 4 minutes for my rebuttal. Given this appeal's myriad issues, I'd like to focus the court's de novo review onto three areas. First, defendants' misstatements and omissions concerning Uber's regulatory compliance efforts. Second, defendants' misstatements and omissions concerning the two major data security breaches. And third, the sufficiency of the complaint's allegations concerning class members' losses that we linked to the defendant's actions. Now, turning to the regulations that were defendants uttered both publicly and in the offering memorandum. On July 12, 2014, Uber issued a statement claiming, quote, "We've been working in good faith with regulators to modernize laws and find a permanent home for Uber in cities," end quote.
That seems true, counsel.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
That seems true, accurate. What's false about that statement?
No, it's both false and misleading, Your Honor. To say that they are working in good faith with regulators while at the same time undertaking the secretive, very likely illegal gray ball operation in major cities around the world, such as Boston, Portland, Las Vegas, and Paris, you can't reconcile.
But weren't they also working with them to try and, to try and become operable in all of these areas, countries and states,
yes,
and localities?
Well, two responses. Number one, yes, they were working with them legitimately, which is true. But number two, even literally true statements can be misleading under the securities laws, and this is a perfect example of one right here because they are coming into these offerings. They're going to be asking investors to part with $10.6 billion of money in these private offerings. The investors and the market know that.
Right, but it's misleading whether it's $5 or $10 billion. I mean, your arguments are the same, and the amount of money isn't.
Well, it would have to be materially misleading. And we believe to state that you are working in good faith with regulators, for Kalanick to tell the BBC, we work with regulators and cities to make things work. And in the offering memorandum in early 2016, under legal and regulatory risks, to note that there are laws and regulations that could expose Uber to liability and could dampen our growth and profits, in the same breath to claim that Uber is, quote, actively challenging, end quote, local laws, I would submit to you that investors would think that actively challenging and working in good faith connotes above board legal efforts to actually work with regulators instead of putting fake apps on their phones so those very same regulators can't see what Uber is doing. And whether or not the investors in the offerings believe that those statements were materially false is a very fact-bound question that is, it's too early in the litigation for that question to be answered as a matter of law at the 12B6 stage. Now, the district court excused those statements as aspirational, and it noted that the defendants didn't claim gray ball was legal. Well, Your Honors, it's not aspirational when the defendants are responding to the market and to market analysts who are specifically questioning the regulatory hurdles that Uber is facing coming into these multi-billion dollar offerings. The defendants didn't claim gray ball was legal is irrelevant. They didn't even disclose its existence, Your Honors. And as I mentioned earlier, the conduct doesn't have to be illegal to be actionable. The securities case law books are full in which.
You're relying specifically on misleading, not omission, meaning if Uber had not said anything about this, your claim wouldn't be the same, right? I mean, you're not suggesting they had affirmative duty to disclose Grayball, or maybe you are, but your argument seems to be stronger slightly because they made an affirmative statement. They disclosed some facts. I mean, they also said, we have a problem in some areas. I mean, part of this issue seems to be, would the investors have known that Uber was not permissible in certain localities? And I guess that's where I'm struggling, because Uber made that disclosure that, you know, they made a whole lot of caveats to the regulatory scheme, and they were working in good faith in many of those to try and get it. Your point is, once you make those positive disclaimers and assertions, you can't also ignore the negative implications that you're doing.
Yes, Judge Nelson, and it's not only my assertion, it is this circuit's assertion. If your honors would look at this circuit's case, Burson, 527 F3rd at 987, it's a basic tenet of securities law that having addressed a certain subject, the defendants then have the duty to be truthful about that subject. They could have kept silent, all right? They could have kept silent about Grayball. They could have kept silent about the second category of misstatements I mentioned, the data security breaches. But instead, they chose to address those subjects. And when they chose to address those subjects, they did owe an affirmative duty to the investors in those four offerings to come clean about it. Now, for example, turning to those data security breaches. Now, responding to the consumers' concerns in around 2000 and in late 2014.
Can I just ask a question about the data breaches? Because it seems to me one of the main problems you have, and I don't know how big of a problem, but as I dug through it, it seems like you're relying primarily upon an unnamed source who made a purported misrepresentation that was reported to the press. Am I accurate in that, or is there more to it that goes to the misstatements in the data breach? Well,
mostly accurate, Judge Nelson. Let's not forget, we're alleging both omissions and misstatements. You put your finger on an affirmative misstatement that appeared in the Wall Street Journal, where an Uber spokesperson said to the Wall Street Journal, quote, Uber has adopted all of the privacy measures requested, end quote, by the New York Attorney General. Now, that's a pretty strong, definitive, verifiable statement. Previous to that, there were some omissions. When they talked about how Uber's privacy experts had performed a comprehensive review in January 2015 and said, quote, overall, our privacy program is strong, end quote, they omitted the 2014 breach that they had just discovered in September. All right.
Well, but to me, I don't know that that's as much of a problem. My question was, an unnamed source in what's the best case you have that an unnamed source in a news article can satisfy the particularity requirement under Rule 9B for pleading a misrepresentation?
Well, Your Honor, Rule 9B, in talking about mistake or fraud, you need to identify the statement.
Who made it?
Where it was made, who made it, and the article.
Who made the statement?
An Uber spokesperson.
Is that enough?
At the pleading stage, it has to be, Your Honor.
I don't know that it has to be, and I'm asking you for your best case. This is very important for the Rule 9B standard. You usually have to have who made it, and it's not just the type of person that made it, but who made the misrepresentation?
Well, as our
brief, when was it made?
You know, Your Honors, I read the Wall Street Journal every day, and every day on the second page, there's a corrections and modifications box in the lower left column. Uber didn't come back the next day and say, what are you doing saying that we've satisfied the New York Attorney General's?
Well, now you're placing an incredible burden that I don't think I would be very hesitant to place on companies to go out and correct every misstatement that's made about the company by the press. That would, I mean, we'd hardly get any business done in this country if that was the legal requirement of every company.
Counsel, I'd like to interject a question for you.
Please.
I think that the distinction that was raised in the questioning by Judge Nelson at the outset is a significant issue to consider. That is the distinction between whether you're contending that that affirmative misrepresentations were made as contrasted with contending that there were material omissions. At least for me, that's important. So I guess I'd like to know, what's your strongest example or examples of actual affirmative misstatements or misrepresentations that were made, because I think those probably need to be tested under the lens of FRCP 9B.
All right. And are we still referring to the data security breaches, Judge Gould?
I'm asking for any, all right, any contentions, those or others.
All right. Well, if, so far as the data security breaches, as I said, the 2016 Series G memo, it expressly referenced the 2014 breach, and it claimed, quote, Uber may be unable to anticipate, end quote, hacking or, quote, implement adequate protective measures, end quote, and thus it could experience negative press and legislative and regulatory action as a result. They affirmatively referenced the breach that investors had just discovered, knowing at the same time that they had not fixed the multi-factor authentication problem that led to that breach, that a year later would lead to the breach of 57 million riders and drivers.
So is that an omission or is that an affirmative mistake?
I believe it's a combination of both, Your Honor. And of course, an omission makes a spoken or an uttered statement misleading by omitting some material facts. And hearkening back to what I said earlier, what Judge Nelson and I were discussing about Fiverr, the fact that Uber chose to address that subject, the data breach, put into play the truth surrounding that data breach, and they omitted the remainder of the information about that. And as we know, when that second data breach happened, they kept quiet for another year. They paid a $100,000 ransom to the hackers to keep quiet about it. And that second breach led to $148 million penalties around the country, and all 50 state attorney generals charging them. And Uber had said in its offering memorandum that our brand identity is critical. It is critical to this company's future. And anything that could affect that brand identity could be detrimental to that future. Knowing that, they chose to speak about these subjects that were near and dear to investors' hearts, and yet they did not tell the full truth. I see I'm getting down to about 3 minutes, so I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time, please.
That's fine. And for you initially, counsel, I think you initially wanted 5 minutes?
4 minutes, Your Honor.
4 minutes. Okay, so we'll give you another minute and 12 seconds, so you'll get your 4 minutes of rebuttal.
I appreciate that.
Good afternoon.
So could the clerk make the clock 4 minutes of rebuttal for Mr. Daly? And then Mr. Ashley is going to go next?
Yes, Your Honor. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I see the clock is already set at 9 minutes. We have split 9 minutes and 6 minutes, Uber and Mr. Kalanick. This court should affirm the district court because the district court faithfully and correctly applied this court's established precedent in dismissing the Second Amendment complaint. And I'm going to address some of the issues that were just raised by this panel and some of the responses that you got. Counsel went directly to regulatory compliance and discussed the working in good faith with regulators to modernize laws statement. And I think you correctly pointed out that that is true. There is nothing about that that is false, but there's also nothing about that that is misleading. This court in retail wholesale.
What about the idea, though, that after they'd said we're working in good faith, and they were one aspect, they were working in good faith. But what about the gray ball? That, I mean, is your position that gray ball was that good faith?
I believe it was, but I think the first question that this
you believe gray ball was good faith.
Yes.
The allegations about gray ball were made. That was good faith working with investors or with regulators.
I don't think it's the question, but I do believe it's good faith for the exact reason that Your Honor mentioned, which is there was a public debate going on at the time about whether or not there were modern rules and regulations with respect to Uber. And several of these regulatory agencies were captured by taxis. So I do believe that you could actually reconcile gray ball with the term good faith. But I don't think that's the key question for the court today. I think in retail wholesale, the court noted that the first question you ask with a statement like we work in good faith with regulators to make things work is, will investors rely on a statement like that to make an investment decision? In other words, is it objectively verifiable? Is it too general? And is it too vague that investors would ever rely on it. And if they don't, then it's not misleading as a matter of law. Whether you call
that seems to be your strongest argument. I'm still stuck on the fact that you're defending Grayball as working with regulators in good faith. I mean, I don't want to focus too much on it given the time you have, but I mean, to blackball effectively, or grayball, I guess is the right term, and prohibit regulators from even accessing Uber doesn't seem to be good faith.
Well, I don't want to get hung up on it, so I'm going to assume.
Let's move on. Let me ask you about the dummy accounts, because I actually had some concern about the dummy. There was Uber book and cancel Lyft rides. I don't know whether they were or they weren't, but the allegations are that they were using dummy accounts. Why isn't that enough to show a misrepresentation?
Well, I don't believe there's an actual allegation that Uber was. There's a conflation that occurs sometimes.
Hold on a second. Don't they argue? Don't they state that Uber had paid people to book rides with Lyft drivers using dummy accounts to try to recruit them to Uber and had employees book and cancel more than 5,000 rides?
No, they don't plead. They never plead that occurred.
Okay.
They plead that it's not that, but that's they were conflating that with Grayball. They claim that Grayball occurred. There is no allegation in the Second Amendment complaint or any of its predecessors that Uber, in fact, created dummy accounts and then canceled rides with Lyft. It's a totally different issue. They never claim that occurred.
Okay.
Now, I do want to get back to the regulations. And, Your Honor, I don't want to get hung up on whether or not it was good faith, because I do think that it's puffery. And I do think they're missing the tethering that this court generally requires whenever you've asked probing questions on whether or not this case is really about misstatements or omissions. And even when a case is based on omissions, they have to be tethered to the statements actually made. You know, this court held that in Brody, and it held that in In Re Rigel. So for instance, in In Re Rigel, a pharmaceutical company released information about a clinical trial, speaking about some side effects, but not about others. And this court held that it wasn't a securities fraud omission to not speak about the side effects that the company didn't discuss, because companies can control what they have to disclose by controlling what they discuss. And I just don't think we work with regulators or phrases like that that you see throughout the complaint imply anything about the statement, I mean, the alleged fraudulent activity. This is clearly a situation in which the plaintiffs have looked for fraudulent activity and then searched for a statement to try to match it. And it's not supposed to work that way. And Your Honor, you noted something about the risk disclosures. Now, we believe they're not even Uber statements, but I do find it odd.
Do you believe they're not because it was a separate made them? I forget the name. I apologize.
New Riders memo.
Yeah.
By Morgan Stanley. Nobody contends Uber controls Morgan Stanley, but I'm not going to get into Janus. We briefed it, and I heard what you said in one of the prior arguments. I don't think we need it in this decision, but I do want to point out, if you go to supplemental excerpts of record 609 to 610, this is excerpting this offering memorandum that constantly gets quoted a few words at a time. Here's what the offering memorandum said that they claim was misleading. Quote, in certain jurisdictions, the company has continued to offer its services despite laws or regulations that could be interpreted to block those services. The company's continuation of this practice may result in fines or other penalties from local regulators, as well as negative press coverage, which may discourage drivers and riders from using the services and could adversely impact the company's profitability. I don't believe they've even alleged that's misleading by omission. It doesn't discuss anything about Grayball or imply anything about it. Now, the other area that they raised was the data security. Now, let's remember something. This plaintiff invested after the 2014 data breach and non-disclosure of it. Now they're saying that because that was perpetrated by multi-factor authentication or the lack thereof, that somehow that's securities fraud. But the only statement that they allege is from a Wall Street, not even the Wall Street Journal, a Wall Street Journal blog. And you asked for the best authority in support of being able to allege an anonymous statement. Here, not only do we not have an anonymous statement, we have an anonymous statement, we also have no quote. So it's an attribution to an unnamed person that's being paraphrased. And we cited this circuit's decision in Kearns v. Ford, which didn't deal with anonymous sources, but dealt with a plaintiff in an unfair competition law action. They couldn't name the company representative that allegedly lied to him. And the court said that doesn't satisfy 9b. We then cited In Re Time Warner from the Second Circuit, which was on point on this issue and explains why you don't allow anonymous sources to satisfy 9B. Their only retort to that was we should have policed it. And we cited Robb versus General Physics out of the Fourth Circuit saying you don't have a duty to police. They don't.
Let me ask you that. Does the Ninth Circuit have case? Because to me, that seems like a pretty fundamental legal issue that needs to be clarified. Does the Ninth Circuit have any case law similar to that in the Fourth Circuit on that there's no need to police?
This was the best we could find. We don't believe there was one in the Ninth Circuit, but we do think that it's practical and it makes sense. And it's probably a continuation and extension of the Kearns case, which, again, didn't use the term anonymous, but said for 9B, you have to at least identify the speaker. That's the bare minimum. I also want to note, just in closing, I think I'm going beyond my time, but counsel referenced the Burson case. And actually, I think the court should read the Burson case. In Burson, that was the case where there were financial statements that expressly touted their backlog orders, tens of millions of dollars in backlog orders. But they left out that those very backlog orders included government stop work orders that could never be received. And that was what was alleged to be an omission, or what was determined by the Ninth Circuit to be an omission that was adequately tethered to the misstatement. And that's what's missing here. And it's missing pretty much throughout the board. I'm not going to go into each one of the statements, but, you know, in conclusion, I'll say the Second Amendment complaint, like both of its predecessors, is long on alleged corporate misconduct, but it doesn't connect that misconduct to actual statements. Plaintiffs are struggling to create that connection still, but it's not there. The district court was correct, and it should be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. I think we will turn to Ms. Harris.
Thank you. May it please the court. Sarah Harris for Appellee Travis Kellen. In addition to the points my co-counsel raised, I will discuss two reasons why this court should affirm the dismissal of plaintiff's suit against Mr. Kellen. First, none of the alleged Kellenic statements are actionable. Plaintiff has waived all but seven. And if those statements are actionable, every general statement of corporate optimism could be securities fraud. And second, plaintiff hasn't alleged any basis for holding Mr. Kellenic liable under California law because he wasn't a direct market participant who could directly effectuate the sale of shares, which is what California law requires. Now, let me start with the actionable statements. There are two fatal problems with plaintiff's position. First is the pleading problem. As Judge Nelson has noted, Rule 9 really requires pleading the who, what, where, when, and why of a securities fraud claim with particularity. But plaintiff has not connected the dots by identifying what is false or misleading about each statement, which is what Rule 9 requires. And second, plaintiff isn't claiming that any of the non-waived seven Kellenic statements are even false. And they certainly aren't misleading as a matter of law. Reasonable investors would discount these types of general expressions of optimism from CEOs. Now, the only statement I heard my friend Mr. Daly mention in his argument from Mr. Kellenic is the statement, quote, "We work with regulators to make things work," end quote. And there are a number of problems with holding that statement to be actionable securities fraud. It fails as a matter of law.
Hey, if you're going to delve in, I rather than retread new ground, I wanted to, since you're the only one with the pulpit, I wanted to turn you to paragraph 75 of the Second Amendment complaint, because I think that does hit on these 5,000 rides on Lyft that were that were booked surreptitiously, if you will, using dumb accounts. And so I'm a little confused by your co-counsel, or I guess not co-counsel, but Mr. Ashley's statement that wasn't alleged in the complaint. So help me out here. If am I misreading paragraph 75 of the Second Amendment amended complaint about the fact that they booked dummy accounts to book 5,000 rides? It seems to be in there.
So you're looking at excerpts of record page 90?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So that paragraph does allege Uber paid people who to book rides with Lyft drivers using dummy accounts to recruit them to Uber. and also had employees book and cancel more than 5,000 rides. I think there's a couple of problems though, because if you look at plaintiff's briefing, what they actually say about the competition with Lyft.
But back up. You're agreeing that it's in the complaint, correct?
I'm agreeing that what I read was an allegation about reports.
Okay. So then go on to your, so that's, okay. I just want to make sure we're all on the same.
Yeah, I'm going to interject here to take a little pressure off Ms. Harris to defend
Mr. Yeah, Ashley. I agree.
But I'm going to give Mr. Ashley an extra minute so he can respond directly.
That's good. So then go on to your, I appreciate that, Judge Gould. Ms. Harris, if you can address the second part of that, because I think where you're going, and this is a question I would have, is that wasn't really raised in the briefing before us. Is that correct?
Correct. And I do, of course, defer to Mr. Ashley with respect to Uber statements and appreciate Judge Gould for giving him the time. But it's correct. The way that plaintiff has framed the issues with Lyft in the briefing, and again, this is sort of a perennial issue with respect to what was raised and what was waived. The allegation with respect to Lyft is that there was some sort of monitoring of Uber and Lyft drivers and sort of an unfair competition type thing. And again, the only allegation remotely on point with respect to Mr. Kalanick on competition are such anodyne statements as, quote, we pride ourselves on being fierce and principled competitors. And if that is securities fraud, then every company in America with an enthusiastic CEO would be committing securities fraud. This is the kind of white noise that investors do not regard as something that they weigh and as a matter of law. And I think you see cases like Retail Wholesale and City of Pontiac in the second.
Can I ask just briefly, I'm sorry, was there another question? Can I ask briefly about the loss causation? Because that seems to be a pretty fundamental flaw in the plaintiff's case, is that of how these statements, assuming they were misstatements or omissions, how it affected the loss. And is that, or do you agree with that position, or I mean, what's required? What's missing from the plaintiff's theory here?
Sure. So with respect to loss causation, I do defer to my colleague, Mr. Ashley, okay, with respect to Uber's arguments as Mr. Kalanick joined them. But we agree, obviously, that loss causation is missing under the relevant standards here, which is 9B. And I think Mr. Ashley...
fair enough. Well, he's got 1 minute. So
he might have a lot in his plate. But I do think this also illustrates the number of flaws with respect to plaintiff's position. There are a number of different independent ways in which the district court's opinion should be affirmed, both with respect to Mr. Kalanick and with respect to Uber. And so if the court doesn't have any questions with respect to the direct market participant issue, which is unique to Mr. Kalanick, that again is another independent basis on which Mr. Kalanick really cannot be held liable. California law is quite clear. And I don't think plaintiff particularly disagrees with the clarity of the requirement that you can't just sort of be someone company. You actually have to be someone in a position who can effectuate the transfer of shares. So if there are no further questions, we ask that you affirm.
Okay, thank you. Now, Mr. Ashley, I'm going to go on a limb here and say you've got 2 minutes.
Okay. Judge Nelson, I did not mean to imply that that statement wasn't in the Second Amendment complaint. It is. What we showed was it's irrelevant to any of their allegations of falsity. So that statement is referenced, the statement at issue is referenced at appellant's opening brief page.
Oh, so your position is that Uber never denied that it was using dummy accounts to book and cancel Lyft rides.
No, Uber did deny it. So that's what I'm getting to. The appellant's opening brief says one of the statements at issue is, quote, a late August 2014 reassurance by Uber that its marketing tactics were above board and transparent in response to charges of using dummy accounts to book and cancel Lyft rides. That's the appellant's opening brief. They cited this very paragraph. Now, the Second Amendment complaint it lists all of the alleged falsity in Uber statements, and it gives Grayball, Hell, alleged theft of trade secrets. Nowhere does the complaint say that this statement was false because Uber was in fact doing that. Uber, what they're setting up in that part of their Second Amendment complaint is that Uber denied it. And what we tried to point out was that subterfuge, because yes, Uber denied that, and they haven't contended that it's not the case, because all they've alleged that was false or that was misleading was that it was Grayball or Hell or one of the other items identified in their complaint. They can't point you to anywhere where their complaint says that this statement where Uber denied that it was doing this was false, much less that it was ever admitted by Uber that it did it.
So you got 28 seconds left. Do you want to loss causation?
I think the briefing speaks for itself largely, but I just want to say this circuit has held Rule 9b applies to loss causation. What they did was group 100+ statements together in one pile and then claimed, hey, there was inflation over several years, so they caused it. And then later there was deflation over a year and a half, and that means the statements must have caused it. It's too gloppy to satisfy Rule 9. And I will also note, it shouldn't go without saying, that even though their statements have changed from the complaint to the First Amendment complaint to the Second Amendment complaint to them disclaiming certain statements in their appellate brief, causation always stays the same. Inflation's identical and deflation's identical. It doesn't satisfy Rule 9b.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ashley. Now, we're going to return to Mr. Daly for his rebuttal argument. I think we said it would be 4 minutes. Is that adequate for you, Mr. Daly?
I think 4 minutes will do it, Your Honor. Thank you. I'm going to dive into loss causation, but I first want to make one preliminary observation. Counsel said that corporate optimism is not actionable. That's precisely 180 degrees away from what this court says in the Quality Systems appeal, which I argued and briefed. Quality Systems, 865 F3rd at 1143. Even general statements of optimism may be actionable given their context. And what was the context here, Your Honors? The market was directly questioning Uber's control over the private data it had collected. Uber expressly warned our clients of the risk of negative publicity from data breaches, so it knew that investors were paying attention to that, and it was asking those same investors to inject $10.6 billion into the company. That was the context for that so-called corporate optimism. Now, loss causation. I understand counsel wants to talk about 9B, but let's talk about the California statute, 25-400. That statute requires, and that's the statute we're proceeding under in federal court, under the class action, we're in here under diversity. That statute requires only that the securities price was affected by defendant's actions. That's all we had to plead. And we certainly
I thought California had said they looked to the federal rules and specifically to 9B in applying its law.
Well, and then if you fit those allegations of how we met the California statute into 9B in the Apollo case, then we've done it. We've pleaded what, using the cash discount flow model, we've pleaded what price was paid in the offerings, that price was 30% inflated, that investors would have discounted the price had they known of the undisclosed risk.
Counsel, let's go to that. Let's go to the... I apologize. I got to find it. Your graph. Was that a graph you created or was that a graph? I mean, where did that graph come from? Is that something that you put together or does this exist in some publicly available source?
It's paragraph 198 of the complaint.
Yeah.
And it looks as though it comes from, various SEC filings. So I don't know the answer to that.
Well, but that's my question. I don't think this graph was in the SEC filings. I think that this is data from the SEC filings that was compiled into a graph. But if you look at it, you have more than half of these where there's no effect at all. Well, one of them, there's a positive impact.
There's no effect at all immediately, and that's true. But two points in response. Number one, as we pointed out to the district court, which did not sway the district court, private shares such as the ones that were offered in these offerings do not respond to external market forces the way publicly traded ones do. And that's this court's decision in the Nuveen case.
Well, but
I mean, how far does that go? So your point is the four that decreased after, I mean, one had started to decrease before. Four of them start to decrease at various points after. Wouldn't they have started to decrease all the same time if they were responding to the same, the same misstatement, if you will?
Two quick responses, Judge Nelson. Number one, you're asking for what defendants had asked for, the immediate reaction to news coming out in the public. And this court in the America West decision says we do not need an immediate reaction. We don't know how often, whether it's quarterly, once a year.
No. That's not my question. My question is not the immediacy of it, but the consistency of it among the four different funds.
Well, I would say consistently over the year, they all reduced their valuation from 28% to 33% of Uber. And let's not forget, in November of that year, the Japanese conglomerate made a tender offer for Uber shares, reflecting a 30% drop in value from the year before. And who sold one? Defendant Kalanick. So he value had dropped.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Counsel. Unless Judge Kelly or Judge Nelson have further questions, but I have none. I'm going to thank Appellant's Counsel, Mr. Daly, and the Appellee's Counsel, Mr. Ashley, and Ms. Harris for their excellent arguments. It's an important case, a difficult case, and the panel will now take it under submission, and the parties will hear from us in due course. So thank you again.